It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On Wednesday, October 1st, at Carnegie Music Hall, award-winning NPR journalist and former All Things Considered co-host Michelle Norris will give a talk entitled Eavesdropping on America's Conversation on Race in conjunction with the exhibition Race, Are We So Different? At the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. In 2010, Ms. Norris released her first book, The Grace of Silence, a memoir, which focuses on how America talks about race in the wake of Barack Obama's presidential election and explores her own family's racial legacy. She is currently a host and special correspondent for NPR and joins us by phone from Washington. Michelle Norris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's great to be with you.
Tell us about your talk on eavesdropping on America's conversation on race. How will you be engaging your Pittsburgh audience on Wednesday?
Well, I have had the chance to eavesdrop on America's conversation about race in an unusual way because I, 4 years ago, started something called the Race Card Project, where I asked people to share their thoughts about race and cultural identity with me in just six words. The deal was you got one sentence, and that sentence could only have six words. And much to my surprise, a very large number of people took the bait and sent in their thoughts and observations and memories and experiences and anthems and laments and hopes and aspirations in these little microbursts, these little six-word stories. And over time, people would send not just the little teeny six-word stories, but they would send in essays, sometimes rather long essays and very interesting essays, explaining the backstory behind their six words. And those stories have allowed me to participate in and to witness a dialogue that would be very hard for me to access from the studios that you and I normally sit in, because people are so candid and they share very personal stories. And then they wind up engaged in dialogues with other people who send in stories. And so I've had a chance to understand the experience about race in a different way. And I plan to share that with the audience, some of the things I've learned, big things, small things, and also to share the inbox, to take people inside the inbox to understand what a rich and wonderful archive this project has become.
What were, say, one or two of the stories that have really stayed with you since folks shared them with you?
Often they're smaller observations. And, Paul, that's one of the big lessons for me, is that the national narrative around race, the big conversation, is often it often hinges on really big moments, like the unrest in Ferguson or the shooting of Trayvon Martin or the election of a black president or the debates over immigration or Asian quotas and universities. But what people often write about are little teeny moments in their lives. So I'll give you two examples. One is if you take a day in history, let's say the day that Dr. King was assassinated, I can take that day and look at it through several different prisms based on the stories that people have sent in. So I know that in college classrooms throughout the American South, that, and it's kind of odd to say this, but I have several cards that reference this, that when the assassination of Dr. King was announced, that students erupted in cheers. And people who were in those classrooms remember that now, either with horror at experiencing it and wondering what are they doing, or sometimes with regret, saying I cheered because that's what everybody did, and now I realize that wasn't such a good thing to do. I know that in some communities, the nuns at schools held students back in the classrooms because they feared, and they were right, that the communities would break out in riots. I know that there were a group of nuns at a Catholic college in Joliet, Illinois, who went to the high tower at the university and watched the area around Joliet burn and decided at that moment to do more work with prison ministries at the prison in Joliet, work that still continues to this day. I know that in New Jersey, there's someone who's really, really angry to this day because he watched people burn his father's store down in the riots. And I also know that there's someone in Memphis who realized on that day, because people protected her father's store, that her father had secretly been selling goods to people of color quietly out the back door, even though that was not the custom or the practice in Memphis. And I know that somewhere in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a woman decided to pay tribute in some small way to the men who worked for her because she knew how much Dr. King meant to them. And she couldn't let her husband know because he would be upset. So, you know, all these little teeny things are really interesting to me. And that's one example. Another example is something that, as a journalist, I might not have explored or even known about that comes in that I know about only because it came in over the transom. And six words, for instance, Paul, I still remember the day it arrived in my inbox. It was sent from Covington, Louisiana by a woman named Michelle, and her six words were, "Black babies cost less to adopt." Mm. And, you know, see, you had the reaction too. I looked at it and went, oh my goodness. But we started to do research on it. And in fact, we did a radio segment on this. And we realized that in America, in the adoption system, state-by-state adoption system in this country, the fees associated with adoption, not that children, you pay for children, you pay a fee. There's a fee structure attached to adoption. And it is true that in almost every state, the fee structure, and it's not by design, it just sort of happened this way, but that the fee structure is such that the fees associated with adopting white children are much higher than the fees associated with adopting children of color. And it happens for a number of reasons. Part of it is they build incentives in the system to lower those fees. No one likes the word discount, but to lower those fees, to incentivize families to make adoption possible, adoption which can be very expensive, possible for families that might otherwise be locked out of that system. But everyone involved in the system admits that it is also a reflection of the simple market forces of supply and demand, and no one is comfortable with that. But those six words wind up taking you, you know, allowing you to look into something that says so much about our value system in America. And so, you know, there are things like that. Someone writes that I'm only Asian when it's convenient, and then goes on to explain when it's convenient and when it's not, and why it's convenient, and what that sort of shape-shifting or code-switching means for them. And so I could go on and on, but I won't. But, you know, the stories, it is amazing, Paul, how much people can pack into just six words, and then how much we can learn from people when they're willing to share their truth.
And I understand that a lot of those six-word quotes came from Pittsburgh. I'm guessing you'll be referring to some of those in your presentation here.
I will. We are hoping actually to collect more of those stories. The Carnegie Museum of Natural History will be inviting people to share their six words if they're coming to the event next week, and also for people who are going to see that wonderful exhibit that is their race, Are We So Different, the exhibit that's been traveling around the country. And the Museum of Natural History has done such a wonderful job of personalizing it for the Pittsburgh community with special exhibits, including the work of Teenie Harris and some of the recollections, not just the pictures, but the recollections that they were able to collect there. So one of the things that I do at the end of most of my lectures is to take a number of the six words, the six word expressions from the website and from the inbox, and put them together, and it almost winds up being almost like a tone poem. And when you read them together, you realize that in some strange way, it does create a kind of dialogue. The person in Okinawa, who sent in six words, almost seems like they're posing a question that is then answered by the person in Oklahoma. And so I quite literally will take people inside the inbox, and I will make sure to, when I do that, include some of the stories that have come from from individuals or from students there in Pittsburgh.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with award-winning NPR journalist and former All Things Considered co-host Michelle Norris, who is giving a talk entitled Eavesdropping on America's Conversation on Race in conjunction with the exhibition Race, Are We So Different? At the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Again, Michelle Norris will be speaking on Wednesday, October 1st. In 2010, Michelle, you released your first book, The Grace of Silence, a memoir which focuses on how America talks about race in the wake of Barack Obama's presidential election and explores your own family legacy. What were the experiences in your family that helped inform the book?
It's the reason that I started the Race Card Project is because after I wrote the book, I realized that when I traveled around the country to talk about it, I would be inviting people to participate in a conversation about race, and I wanted to create an entry point for that conversation because those conversations are not always difficult or not always easy. I grew up in a family. I was raised in Minnesota. My mother's side of the family is from Minnesota. My father's side of the family is from Birmingham, Alabama, and I spent my childhood going back and forth between those two cities. And the stories that I discovered kind of, I don't want to say by accident, but stories that just sort of rose to the surface around the election season in 2008, around the time that President Barack Obama was elected, formed the basis of the memoir that I wrote. Suddenly the older people in my family were sharing stories that they hadn't shared before about civil rights America, about at least America before the civil rights victories, about America under a Jim Crow system. And when they shared these stories, I realized that as much as I thought I knew about my family members, the older members of my family, including my parents, there was so much I didn't know, that they had seen and experienced so much, and they kept so much of it to themselves, and that's why I called the book The Grace of Silence. They kept it to themselves in part because they wanted us to march forward in life free of the burdens that they faced and free of the pain that they experienced, so that we would have a better chance to, you know, to fully experience America and all of its opportunities. And I didn't know, for instance, that my mother's mother had worked as a traveling Aunt Jemima in the Midwest, or even that there were an army of Aunt Jemimas that dressed up in hoop skirts and headscarves and sold pancake mix and made good money doing it. And since I've discovered that many of the other women who did this, their families were in similar circumstances. They just didn't talk about it, you know, that their families, too, were just discovering this as I did. And so that was, you know, one of the discoveries. And I wanted to go back and research and find out as much about those women and how they did their work and how they were received in the communities. And it turned out that the work they did was a big deal. When they traveled to communities, they were treated like celebrities. But it, you know, for many families, including my own, it was complicated to look back at that moment because the Aunt Jemima that she portrayed, and I'll talk about this next week, the Aunt Jemima she portrayed was not the one that you see on the pancake box today. It was someone who looked more like a slave. But I realized that my grandmother and many of the other women who were doing this work took the stage that was available to them at that point in life and used it to lift themselves up through their earnings and in the way that they carried themselves to lift their people up by serving as ambassadors, often going into small towns to do these demonstrations where people had not seen women of color, and women of color who carried themselves with such dignity and who spoke with such diction and grace. And that was, you know, that was surprising and in some ways painful, but ultimately wonderful to discover because it's part of my history and it's a part of American history that I really didn't know about. And that's one of the other reasons that I wanted to create this basket where people could tell their stories, because so many of us don't know the full story of where we came from and what our ancestors did and how they got over and how they made it, you know, not just how they embraced the opportunities that America afforded, but also how they met the challenges when they came here, because so many of us in this country ultimately did come from someplace else, and in passing down our stories, sometimes the more difficult or the more painful aspects of those stories get rubbed away. And so I encourage people through this project and whenever I speak to try to capture those stories when you can, because they're such an important part of your history.
Well, in looking at how we confront issues of race in the United States, and also, Michelle, how you have engaged and shared with readers your own family's history, is so much of it about simply having the conversation? And one example that comes to mind is something that happened to me recently at a banned books event held here in Pittsburgh, in which the presentation, a gentleman came up to me, and he was white and Jewish, and had said that a reading that was done that night from Huck Finn reminded him of a friendship that he had with a fellow student on the track team at his high school who was black and Asian, and who, I'm guessing from this gentleman's age, their friendship dated to before the civil rights era really began in earnest. And he said that he reunited with his friend years later, and that his friend told him how miserable he was. He had been subjected to a lot of racism, and that his experiences years ago were very, very painful. And they never talked about it until just recently, just before this African-American man died. And the white gentleman was saying how much it meant to him to have had that conversation and how cathartic it was for both of them to truly discuss what this young man had gone through. And it struck me then that really it's about talking through a lot of this, isn't it?
Or the opportunity to have that conversation. I mean, what a wonderful story that they were able to close that circle and actually, you know, have that that dialogue. And we're told over and over again that this subject is something that is supposed to be difficult to talk about, and then that becomes a self-affirming prophecy. Oh, it's supposed to be difficult because we say it's difficult to talk about. I mean, if I were naming this little project that I do, again, I think I might call it Glad You Asked, because so many people say, oh, my goodness, thank you for giving me a chance to tell this story. And the story that you just told, Paul, is reflected in many ways, certainly in the inbox. Because if you think about the history of America, anyone over a certain age remembers America that was full of divisions. You know, where you could eat, where you could live, what kind of friendship you could have or could not have. And there is, you know, I don't want to say there's a lot of regret around that, but there are a lot of people who look back and wonder what kind of friendships might I have been able to have. Or, you know, look back and wonder, what if I had been able to cross that color line or that, you know, because there were all kinds of barriers, not just color barriers, but class barriers and social barriers. And sometimes people are able to go back and talk about that with the people who were there and present, but sometimes they just want an opportunity to talk about it in real time also. And that's where your families and your friendships, wherever circle you happen to be in, can provide a space for you to have that conversation. And it doesn't always have to be formal. I mean, one of the things that I think is wonderful about the story you just told is it wasn't part of any kind of program where people came together and said, now we're going to talk about this moment in American history. They just found each other, and it was very organic, and they made it work. And that's part of the reason that story to me is so rich, is that it wasn't part of any kind of social engineering. You know, it was just two people who had a story to tell who found it. And who did one of the most powerful things that any of us can do. They didn't just tell their story, they listened to each other. And often listening can be an act of courage, but listening, anytime you listen to someone else's story, you honor them. It is an expression of honor and respect. And if the story is difficult, an incredible demonstration of grace as well.
So now here we are, it's 2014, almost 2015. How would you characterize how Americans are talking about race today as opposed to 5 years ago when you wrote your book? Have things changed significantly?
I would say they have. And I think that there is a much more robust and roiling conversation about race, a lot of it in social media. Some of it productive, some of it prickly. Some of it not so productive, perhaps.
Yes.
You know, you see all facets of it, but I think in social media in particular, it has allowed this space where people can say things that they might not say out loud face-to-face, and also where people can comment a lot of it anonymously. So if you read a story about race or sometimes almost anything, and it slides into the, you know, the area of race, that comment section can feel like a rain of fists. But at the same time, I don't know that that's necessarily totally unproductive, because it allows you to see the various, you know, sentiments that actually are out there. I mean, if it's going to be a conversation about race, it's not likely always going to be sunny and easy. And that has become one of those places where you can peek in and see sort of all aspects of the conversation, including the more difficult, you know, aspects of that. But, you know, and one other place I think where you see probably a big change is, you know, generationally, young people just don't carry the same kind of baggage around the issue. It's a little bit easier for them to have these conversations, to talk about these conversations, and to talk about these issues, and so they sort of push us forward. And then I guess I just noticed a change in media and in entertainment in general. I mean, the America that is reflected back at you through mass media in general, whether it's through journalism or through entertainment, sort of looks more like the America that you experience if you go to the mall or the baseball stadium. And that is something that I have seen change significantly in the last decade, but more significantly in the last 5 years. I mean, America's going through, we're sort of mid-turn, you know, like when you turn a page of a book,
mm-hmm.
sort of mid-turn right now, and witnessing and experiencing and really living through some dynamic changes, demographic changes, social changes in the country, and a lot of it is really driven by the changing demographics of the country. And that will affect us in lots of ways that I'm not sure we fully understand. And so the conversation around race is starting to reflect that. And when we talk about race for so long, Paul, didn't it seem like conversations about race always seem to come up, you know, around civil rights ideas? It was always around, you know, rights, and it was usually around the relationship between Black America and white America, and, you know, a conversation that sort of flowed out of America's history.
Right.
Reaching slavery through civil rights, through, you know, and that kind of dominated the conversation about race. And the other thing that I've seen, and not just in the inbox, but that I sort of see and witness just, you know, traveling about America, is that conversation is much more multi-hued, because America is much more multi-hued than just Black America and white America. So when you talk about race, it's almost like we need a new term, because it's not always about race. It's often just about cultural identity. You know, there's a large, fast-growing Latino population in this country. Well, race isn't the portal where they enter that conversation, because for that community, it's not always about race. In fact, it's not often about race. It's about ethnic culture and cultural identity. And yet, in talking about America's larger identity, if that community, in all of its various hues and variegations, is not part of the conversation, that conversation's not complete. And that's true for Arab Americans and for Asian Americans, and for all kinds of hyphenated, you know, Americans. And class is, you know, is also part of that. Things that have nothing to do with skin color or maybe ethnic or you know, a cultural vein. So the conversation about race is, I think, changing, and is much more variegated and much larger, and is kind of a more rich and also more complex tapestry, which makes it perhaps more complicated, but I think also more interesting.
My guest has been Michelle Norris. She is currently a host and special correspondent for NPR. She is author of the book, The Grace of Silence, a memoir, and she is speaking next Wednesday, October 1st, at Carnegie Music Hall, giving a talk entitled Eavesdropping on America's Conversation on Race in conjunction with the exhibition Race, Are We So Different? At the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Michelle Norris, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be with you. Have a great day.
Coming up, we'll hear more about what it takes to conserve one's voice into old age. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.